Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. We are keeping it real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guests today are Jason Renaud and Dr. Rochelle Silver from the Mental Health Alliance. We're recording this interview a few days before the settlement hearing between the City of Portland and the United States Department of Justice. We're talking about the issue of police body-worn cameras. And I want to thank you both for being here.
You're welcome to be here.
Great. I want to start out, can you talk about the Mental Health Alliance, either of you who would like to, and who's in it and what work do you do?
Sure. The Mental Health Alliance was formed in about 2018 to join USDOJ versus City of Portland and to talk about the findings of the DOJ that found that the City of Portland Police Bureau have a pattern and practice of harming people with mental illness. The Alliance is made up of four organizations, Disability Rights Oregon, the Interfaith Clergy Resistance, the Mental Health Association of Portland, and the Oregon Justice Resource Center. There's about 25 individual members. The group meets weekly with experts from around the field to form our testimony and information for the court.
How long have you been doing that? I mean, how long have you been around?
Well, we've been meeting with each other since 2018, but in different forums, the same people in this group have been working on police reform for decades.
That's what I thought, too. So I would like to jump into this issue that you've been working on, that this hearing that's going to be coming up, the hearing that's coming up on Monday. What's going to happen there?
This is a status hearing. And there are some specific issues that will be addressed, body-worn cameras being one. I think that they will also be talking about whether the city and the DOJ have agreed to have a special master as opposed to the kind of oversight that they have had for the last almost 10 years.
Listeners, I have to say, this is, in my opinion, a complex information. So bear with us as we climb through it. Jason sent me a whole bunch of documents, legal documents, before this interview, and I've been looking through them. There's a lot going on here, and so I want to bring Jason back to the microphone and say, now what is on the table with this discussion?
So if we could just back up for a minute and talk about the origin of the case.
Perfect.
The United States Department of Justice has done these sorts of cases where they come to a city to investigate the police bureau for civil rights violations, whether they've been harming people unnecessarily, whether they've been using unconstitutional forms of policing. And they were requested by Earl Blumenauer and Dan Saltzman to come to Portland to do this. The city of Portland and the federal government asked for the DOJ to come to Portland to investigate the police bureau, and they did. And this was under Tony Perez, was the head of the DOJ at that time. And they found that Portland had, and it was surprising findings, they found that the city of Portland and the police bureau had a pattern and practice of harming people with mental illness. Now, these pattern and practice suits, I said, have been going on for a while. We have them in Seattle and Chicago and Cleveland and other places. The findings in those cities were that those police bureaus had a pattern and practice of harming people of color, specifically black men. And so Portland was a new finding, that they did not find that there was a racial component to Portland, but that there was a component around mental illness. Now, since then, three other cities have also been found to have this component of mental illness: Albuquerque, Louisville, and just recently Minneapolis. And so the DOJ has learned from Portland that this is a natural component of police use of force, that excessive use of force against people with mental illness, and they're finding it now in other cities.
I'm moving slow because there's a lot going on here, and people have been working on this ever since I've lived in Portland, which was starting in the 1980s. So jumping ahead a little bit to this issue of the body cameras, which I think, is that the main issue that's really being discussed, would you say?
Well, we have been involved in conversations about body-worn cameras in this case for, I think, about 3 years.
Perhaps, yes.
And we've been in the midst of a mediation about these cameras between the parties and the intervener, the Portland Police Association. And I think they have nailed it down to what they want to do.
Right. I think the city and the Portland Police Association have come to an agreement. The sticking point was whether officers could review the body-worn camera data prior to writing a report. And they have made an agreement that in certain cases relative to specific uses of force, they cannot, and in other cases, they can.
What? Dr. Silver, what's wrong with that? Like, why do I assume there's something wrong with that? Well, can you explain that a little more? Why is it important? Why it's an important turning point?
Well, the community, the Mental Health Alliance, and other groups involved in this case have been very opposed to the police officers being able to review the body-worn cameras before they write their report. Their report should be based on what they think was happening at the time and why they believe they were able to take a specific action, like using a weapon or some other form of force. The police association takes a different point of view, that information is information, and the officers should be allowed all the information available in writing their report.
What the police union doesn't want is for there to be a game of gotcha, that the officer writes a report, then they review the video, and then they get disciplined for there being some variance between what they thought and what the video shows. And that's a reasonable concern. And that's why there's this mediation to say, well, in certain circumstances, we should have this criteria. In certain circumstances, we should waive it.
Is this typical of the other body-worn camera policies in other locations, in other states?
Actually, I don't know.
I think it is not unusual. What is most unusual is that there be zero ability for the officers to review body-worn camera footage, though that was certainly the recommendation of both the Mental Health Alliance and our partner, Amicus, the Albina Ministerial Coalition for Peace and Justice Reform.
Oh, let me just walk it back a little bit. And can you explain what that means? That Mental Health Association, the Mental Health Alliance, and the Albania Ministerial Alliance are friends of the court. Like, can you just explain what that means within this process for people who just showed up and don't even know what we're talking about?
Sure. And Amicus is a group that has requested from the court to participate at a higher level in the court proceedings. We feel that we represent people whose interests are at stake in the outcome of this case, those persons with mental illness, and that those voices were not well represented by either the parties or by the intervener, which is the Portland Police Union. So we requested this. Now, that was opposed. Our entrance into the case was opposed by the union and the city. And I think the DOJ was neutral about it, as I remember. But Judge Michael Simon is the decider of this, and he said, yes, bring these guys in. And it's been very gracious since then. We have excellent access to all information about the case. We're invited to all mediations and have a seat at the table, which is entirely because of Judge Simon.
I need to say that there are specific mediations between the city and the DOJ, which we are not invited to.
Oh, yes. That are about personnel matters. And there's reasons for that, which we don't agree with, but we understand.
All right. If you just tuned in the coming week, there's going to be a meeting a settlement hearing between the city of Portland and the United States Department of Justice. They're going to be talking about, they're basically, is this the moment when they're going to be green lighting, actually sticking the cameras on the cops? Like, where are we with that?
They have been talking about this for a long time, and they have a pilot that's going to start, a 60-day piloting with a certain number of police officers very soon. They have the equipment now. They're doing the first sort of training, but this is the check mark in court saying, yes, we're going to do this.
So I think it's a 60-day pilot program and will only include police officers from Central Precinct.
I have so many questions. My head it's just throbbing with questions. After all these years to get to this point, it seems like a lot of things happened all at once, kind of in a way, in the past couple of months, but it hasn't been like that. People have been talking about this for years. They've been bringing this issue to the front. I want to ask you about a little bit about the police union. Has their opinion changed since you started this process? What is your take on whether their work is good faith? I just have to put it like that, and I don't mean to be negative.
Well, it matters what your point of view is. If you're a police officer, they're doing great work. They're very well. The police officers on the street are very well represented by their labor attorneys. But there's a variance between what the community wants and what the police are providing, and that's where the constant friction is.
I believe that there has been no change with the police union. They typically take a very hard stance in looking at what the community wants or the community is proposing, and then they get into some mediation with the city based on collective bargaining rules and come to some agreement, which almost never is what the community wants in total.
I want to take a step sideways now, and Jason, you have been participating in the past. You were on the Police Accountability Commission, and did they have an important role in this?
The police union?
The Police Accountability Commission.
Oh,
the PAC.
An important role in body-worn cameras?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Just curious. To just stay on this issue of I want to say citizen-led. I don't mean that you have to be a citizen. Grassroots engaged police accountability committees. Can we just talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. The original settlement agreement had two parts, basically, to the oversight. A group that the city hired out of Chicago called the COCAL, and there was a community group attached to that called the COAB, Community Oversight Advisory Board. I was a member of that for 2 years. The city will tell you that that group failed because of internal strife. However, my opinion is that it failed because the city did not support it in multiple ways. Starting from the beginning, they didn't provide training. They didn't keep the membership up. They didn't intervene when there were problems, and they let it end. They then, a year later, because it was required by the DOJ and the settlement agreement, created another group called the PCEP, or Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing.
You got it.
That group has been going sort of on and off since 2018. But again, there's been a great deal of problem with the city keeping the group intact and allowing for new members to come when there are empty spots, and even in allowing people who want to re-up for their position to be okayed by the city. At the current time, there are supposed to be 13 members of the PSEP. There are only 11, and there hasn't been a full commitment for a very long time, and the city doesn't seem to take this too seriously.
Let me speak a little bit about how committees are really embedded in the settlement agreement.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask what bureau is running that and you know, under which commissioner, city commissioner, is supposed to be overseeing that.
But it's the mayor's office in this case.
But so it's just the mayor's office. It's not the mayor in his capacity of overseeing the police. It's the mayor's office.
That's right.
And we're talking about over the involvement of multiple mayors, too. Like,
that's
I don't think we can blame just one.
I think we can.
Blame is a strong
word. I think we can. because Ted Wheeler is the person who ended the COAB, and he has been then responsible for the PSEP.
I was going to blame a different mayor.
Okay, let's do it.
Well, I think when the settlement agreement was first negotiated, Sam Adams was mayor, and Sam had a couple of ideas at that time. And at that time, one of the acute problems in City Hall was the excessive influence of lobbyists. And Adams's idea of how to counterbalance this was to create these large committees to answer all kinds of questions in all kinds of departments of the city. It was a very idealistic solution. Sometimes it worked. Most of the times it didn't work. But in the settlement agreement, he really insisted that the settlement agreement include a community-based way of looking at the development, the changes that the police bureau were undergoing, and then be able to report back to validate, to authenticate that change to the community. And that was this COAB that he suggested. And Portland was unique in a sense in these pattern practice suits as being the first case to not have a court monitor, but instead have this combination of an academic doing the research, doing the evaluation, and then that academic would write a lengthy, complex, and comprehensive report that the PSEP would then be able to review and then say, this is real, this is not real, this is what we want, this is not what we want. And that has been a very complicated process, a big demand on the part of volunteers. Most of the time, it's not gone very well. Sometimes it's gone very well, especially recently, maybe in the last couple of years, as the PSEP has done some large community online meetings and brought forward some big ideas, for example, ShotSpotter.
Yeah, their most recent town hall was about whether Portland should have some kind of gun detection equipment, and ShotSpotter was one of the companies competing for that job. There was another committee, which maybe you want to talk about, the focus group, was in favor of having gun detection equipment. The people on the PSEP were not, and they had a town hall, and a lot of people came and screamed. as a result, Ted Wheeler didn't say we aren't going to do it. He said we'll put it on pause.
So if I understand it correctly, the big critique of ShotSpotter is that it doesn't actually help the police not aggress people who are over aggressed already. Do you understand what I'm saying? It doesn't fix the problem of the racism.
There are many problems with ShotSpotter. The technology doesn't work, and it also has an enormous number of false negatives which draw police into communities which they would not otherwise be in.
That's amazing. If you just tuned in, our guests are Jason Renaud and Dr. Rochelle Silver from the Mental Health Alliance. We're recording this interview a few days before the settlement hearing between the City of Portland and the United States Department of Justice on the Portland Police Bureau use of body-worn cameras. And we're talking about a few different things. We're talking about the process, but keep your eye on that ball. So when you hear this interview, you're gonna already know what happened with that. And I want to give it back to you both. What do you think is going to happen on Monday? Now, this is like weird crystal ball, you know, timey-wimey kind of Doctor Who stuff right now, because we're in the past and this is going to be in the future in a second. But what do you think is going to happen?
Well, we're going to hear from the city and from the Department of Justice about progress that they've seen at the Portland Police Bureau and in surrounding agencies that associate with the police bureau, such as Emergency Communications or Portland Street Response. And then we'll also hear from the intervener, the police union. And then we'll hear from this Kokel, which is now an academic researcher from Chicago, whose name is Tom Christie.
Christoph.
And he'll come in and give his independent evaluation. We'll probably also hear from members of the PSEP.
Correct.
And we'll hear from the Albina Ministerial Alliance. And we'll hear, I wrote the testimony this morning that we'll give.
What do you wish would happen? What do you think should be happening right now?
Well, I think one of the things that we've focused on over and over again as our role in this settlement agreement is the what we call Section 5 within the settlement. Now, the settlement agreement has over 200 items associated with it. So there's a big complicated matrix of what works and what doesn't work. But the Department of Justice and the City of Portland are in agreement that the Police Bureau is in compliance of some sort or another with everything in the settlement agreement at this point. Is that right? Everything?
Well, to some extent, they're not in not compliance, but they aren't perfect yet.
But they're certainly so much better or so much more in the green zone, as it were, than in the red zone, as they were just after the 2020 protests, when a lot of items went suddenly into the red zone.
So they have made quite a bit of progress in training specifically, like maybe 100% of their trainings are happening and they are correct and people are following through, et cetera, et cetera. They still need some work in accountability. The accountability problem is always slow to be coming forward. They don't meet the 180-day deadline. There are some other areas where the police and the city need more work, but some of the primary issues have been taken care of, including the fact that use of force against all peoples are going down.
Justin, we were talking before we started this interview out in the lobby, and you mentioned there's secret good things happening. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. We don't know all of why use of force is going down. That's kind of still a mystery. We have some guesses, and we'll be issuing a report in a few months with those ideas. But just one example is that people might not remember or know about that happened here a couple of years ago was Project ABLE. Project ABLE comes from Georgetown University, and it's a training that police officers do with each other that shows how individual officers working together can intervene upon each other. If one officer sees another officer performing some sort of unconstitutional policing, such as excessive use of force, they are now welcomed by the Portland Police Bureau to stop that right then and there, not to stand back and be an observer. This is the problem we saw in Derek Chauvin, is that you had one officer executing the force and three officers watching it. Now they're all going to prison. So Project ABLE has been very successful. It was taken on by then Chief Jamie Reich, who's now down in Springfield. She trained every police officer to do this. And now we're seeing, that may be one of the reasons we're seeing this decrease in use of force.
That's fascinating, because I am old now. And I find myself always going back into these negative mindsets around law enforcement, even though I know that this is such a cliche, but I actually know a bunch of cops. I know some good cops. I know some bad cops, but I know they're not all bad. And it's difficult not to be very, very cynical about this issue.
Well, I think it's easy for the community to be cynical, yeah, and to not be trusting. So one of their positions is basically that the use of force has gone down because the police aren't doing anything. They don't come to calls. They're late. They're not active.
Yeah, we all saw the recent memo by Chief Chuck Lavelle that basically to the police bureau saying, stop trash talking the town when you're out there doing your job. That fascinated me.
Yeah, we don't exactly know why, but here's the dilemma is that trust, whether it's between you and another person or between one organization and another, trust, if it's broken, is broken instantly. And if it's repaired, that repair goes on over a long duration of time. So that story about the trust being broken, that's a good news story. The repair news story, not so interesting. So it's incumbent on the police bureau to tell us about how they're repairing the trust that's been lost, because the radio media is not doing that.
You know, this issue, and you just brought it up, over who even covers city politics, right? There's so few reporters left. All across the city, especially covering City Hall, and the legislature is an even worse problem because it's bigger, and that's where the laws, that's kind of like the headwaters of how we live, actually. But this issue, it's amazing to me when you're talking about the trust, and this has been such a long slog. Right? Can we shift gears a little bit and talk about, we were gonna jokingly list all of the police accountability committees that we'd ever heard of, and Justin's like, well, there's actually 18. Like, Jason, hello. Can you?
We've only known each other for 20 years.
At least, maybe more. I'm not even going to say that I'm getting over COVID right now and I have brain fog, but can you talk a little bit about just the history of police accountability committees in this that we know of? I mean, maybe people were doing this in the 50s too, not even talking about that, but just within our lifetime.
So we've really been doing police reform here for about 45 years. The kickoff was prior in, I think about 88, with a document that Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and Mark Jolin, who just recently retired from the Joint Office on Homelessness Services, wrote. And what they say should happen, their prescription of this document is exactly the same as current thought. We really are struggling with the same issues decade after decade. But after Sam Adams introduced this idea of committees being integrated into police reform, the city really bit down. In the past, before the co-op, we had, under Rosie Sizer and chiefs earlier, we had something called the Chiefs Forum, which was just a Wednesday lunch, just like bring your brown bag. There was no security. There was no agenda. Cops would come maybe advocates would come, and it was just a conversation. But now that I counted, and you added one, it's 19. Well, the Citizens Review Commission, that's number one. That's appointed by the mayor. That's part of the Independent Police Review. And they look at appeals of complaints against the police. And Rochelle, you were on the CRC.
Right. I was a member of the Citizen Review Committee, CRC, for 2 terms or 5 years. And they do look at appeals. So when a person in the community files a complaint against the police and it is reviewed and a decision is made, if the community member is dissatisfied with that review and response, they can appeal to the Citizen Review Committee. A Citizen Review Committee reviews the case. Unfortunately, they cannot allow new information to come in, and their standard of review is something that they have been wanting to change for years. It is currently a reasonable person standard of review, and that's not acceptable to do this work.
In addition to the CRC, which is part of the IPR, we also have what you mentioned earlier is the Police Accountability Committee. And that group has been meeting since almost 2 years now. They're going to produce their final report for City Council at the end of this month. And they're advising the formation of an accountability board, a very large board that would be very well resourced. And that's already generating quite a bit of controversy at City Council. Both Commissioners Gonzalez and Mapps have said this needs to be amended. Wheeler sort of chimed in on that. So that's going to be a conversation that's going to be going on in September, October, November. There's something called the FITCOG, which we mentioned a little bit earlier, the Focused Intervention Team Community Oversight Group. This is a group of people who are hand-selected by the mayor to look at specific ideas around how police can be more successful at intervening in the community. They were the group that endorsed the ShotSpotter. They are still meeting, and that committee is facilitated by city employees. So there's about, let's see, there's about, in the PSEP, there's 13 members, there's 20-some members on the PAC, and there's 11 or 12 members on the FITCOG. And then there's the police Bureau-wide advisory committee, and they advise the chief and the upper deputies, chief deputies, about citywide issues, including things like the budget development and long-term projects, and they also provide some feedback about community priorities. A subset of that group is the budget advisory committee, which just talks about the police budget, and a subset of that, also of the Bureau-wide advisory committee, is the behavioral health unit advisory committee. And this is just to talk about the behavioral health unit. These are police officers who intervene in mental health crises. This is the also staffed by police officers selected by the mayor. And that is the only one of these committees that I'll talk about that is closed to the public. We're not allowed to go to that meeting. It's a locked door. Then there's the coalition of advisory groups. Now, this is a meeting of people who go to meetings. These are the leaders of all of these committees. And they are also staffed, selected by the mayor, and they're trying to collaborate between these different committees so they're not all piling on the same thing at the same time. And they have 8 advisory groups. 6 of those advisory groups are community and culturally specific groups, and they are the African American Advisory Council, the Alliance for Safer Communities, which used to be, which represents the LGBTQ community, used to have a different name. I think it was the Sexual Minorities Roundtable or something like that. That didn't sound good. Then there's the Asian and Pacific Islanders Advisory Council, and there's the Latino Advisory Council. I'm not sure that's still meeting. There's the Muslim Advisory Council, and I'm really sure that's not meeting. And the Slavic Advisory Council, and that's definitely meeting. Next, there's the Police Equity Advisory Council, and that's a council that of citizens selected by the police and the chief of police that inform the police bureau about equity issues in relation to the racial equity plan that the police put out a few years ago. Then there's the, and I think this is almost final, the Training Advisory Council, which is staffed by city employees. These are all different staff people. There's no crossover here. And not much crossover between members of these committees. So the TAC has 11 or 12 members, and they meet to review the training policies for the police bureau. And as Dr. Silver said, that has improved quite a bit under the new police training director, which was hired as part of the settlement agreement. Then finally, each precinct, and there's 3, they have their own advisory councils. To talk to the commander at that precinct. And there's not much information out about those. So this is a lot of community engagement, a lot of people involved, a lot of staff time. The question is, does this improve the relationship between police officers and people in the community? Does it improve, if I'm a person with mental illness and I'm in crisis, am I more likely to accept the help of a police officer, or am I more likely to run?
This, if you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving. This is Keeping It Real. Our guests in the studio are Jason Renaud and Dr. Rochelle Silver from the Mental Health Alliance. We're recording this interview a few days before the settlement hearing between the City of Portland and the United States Department of Justice regarding body-worn cameras for police officers. But there's so many intertwined issues here. And whenever I sit down with someone who is actually knows what's going on, it makes my head spin at the things that I never read about in the news. And there's so much ink spilled on this, so much different kinds of ink spilled on this. You know, one of the things that gets me is, and you mentioned it, there's current members of the city council who are all, most of them are pretty newly elected, and they seem hell-bent on turning away the actual public the results of public engagement from voting, election results, to what you're talking about, like all of these engagement committees. And here you have a couple of commissioners that are like, no, I don't feel like the drapes match the curtains, and I want to like change it so that it's what I want. Or actually, I mean, how does that hit you? Like, what do you think about that? And I want to also say, one of the things that bums me out about a lot of these committees, now I have not seen every application for them or every call for applications, but virtually everyone that I've ever seen has a clause in it that says, if you're going to apply for this, you have to have a neutral attitude towards law enforcement or something like that. Everyone has a clause that say you can't be a cop hater and be on this committee. And that's me being talking in code. I've never seen an application that just seemed to really accept all people. And I mean, am I imagining that?
Mm. No, I think that there are certainly people on many of these committees who are extremely skeptical of police action and very dubious of police change, and have been vocal about that, and then are reminded by staff that that doesn't behoove them in being long-term on these committees.
I mean, what the hell?
But there are people who are questioning, and there are people who are challenging. Not all these folks are rubber stamps.
Listen, I remember, and we were talking about this PIAC, and I don't remember what PIAAC, I think is what it stood for. But that's the first time I really even had an entree into this issue. And I remember watching a bunch of do-gooder people who were pretty bourgeois, who had become disillusioned through the work on that committee.
And they all walked out.
And that's exactly what happened. They all walked out. And we were talking about the cockle and the cockles and mussels and, you know, Molly, whatever, singing by the side, you know, this whole issue of the cockle and the cola. I'm not even getting that right. It's cockle and
cocoa and coab.
See, they were shut down. They sort of went away with a whimper. I mean, they didn't quit, but they
not
sort of
a whimper.
Well, all right. But I mean, I don't, again, and that's the other part that gets me too, is like, I don't feel like we have reporters at these things for the most part, but I don't necessarily feel like all the most important information makes it to my ears that I care about. So these issues of who's on these committees, why is it important that they're there? What happens with their input? And then what's the output in the end? Like to us, it's that is what sausage making is. But I just wish that I could believe it made sense. And it feels like Rock'em Sock'em Robots. Am I misstating that?
I don't think so. One of the most recent examples is the Police Accountability or a Police Accountability Commission. 20 members have worked diligently to put forth a police accountability system that the voters, 82% of them, have asked for. And they are now facing five electeds, they call themselves electeds, who think that they know better than 82% of the voters. And I think they've even said that perhaps the voters don't understand certain things, or we know better, and we can't allow the voters to be hoodwinked into some plan that is over the top or it isn't going to work. And so it is our job to protect the voters, and therefore we want to change this, this, and this.
What they told us to do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is happening with the new city commissions, like the new reorganization of the city as well, in ways that it shocks me. But, you know, if we could just stay on this for a second, what does that do in terms of the people who participate on these committees? Because it's not a casual thing. It's not exactly like getting married, but it's a big commitment.
Well, I think
it's a time commitment, and it's an emotional commitment.
We talked at the very beginning of the Portland Accountability Commission about the likelihood of political meddling, that would be almost an expected outcome as we got closer to finishing the report. And that's occurred. There's a mayor's race that's getting started, and these people have the opportunity they can grab the microphone and do this. I think it's discouraging to volunteers, but it's not going to stop them. It's not going to stop them from producing their report.
What do you?
Well, there are some volunteers who have been in this from the beginning with the PIAC and all its iterations, they aren't going away.
No.
There are some people who temporarily or permanently get disgusted, but all of the people who have ever been involved in police reform still have their ears, I think. And they're listening and they're watching and waiting to step in when they can.
And that's our task with the Mental Health Alliance, is to be fully informed and to watch these cases go by and to be able to get to the table at any time on any of these subjects and be fully engaged. It's very difficult to follow from the outside.
Jason, we were talking in the lobby. Everybody knows it already. Everyone listening knows that you and I were talking in the lobby. You mentioned to me that people killed by Portland police have one thing in common. And talk about that.
Well, we found that looking back over the years that there's two common themes amongst people who the Portland police use force against. And one is that they're almost all men. And two is that they're almost all affected in some way or another by mental illness, alcohol, or drugs. And that doesn't take the police off the hook, but that is an insight into how these sort of confrontations can escalate. And so we've brought that conversation to the table because that's an injury to these people that was not understood before we started looking at it and is now well understood, not only here in Portland, but across the country.
That's amazing. I still have almost more questions than I have answers, which is, I mean, let me just go here and say, for people who care about this, what's the best source of information, the best source of reporting that you've seen on the issues that you're dealing with that you're talking about right now, locally?
Well, people can read the Oregonian, the Willamette Week, the whatever other newspapers are current. They can listen to you, to the radio. I don't think there is one good source.
No, it's an overwhelming media atmosphere right now, so it's hard to really separate the wheat from the chaff. I would not look at the local television news. That's I think, the best thing to do. And when you stop doing that, everything gets a lot clearer. You watch TV news, don't you?
I do watch TV a lot. I'm a news junkie.
I am an information hoarder. I want to say that Portland Cop Watch puts out, I feel as if it's a quarterly newsletter,
yep,
that's absolutely comprehensive on issues of police accountability.
I would definitely, if you can muster just a few dollars, Portland Cop Watch will send you this newsletter. And it is a very comprehensive review of everything that's going on. That would be the top source.
They know everything about everything that's happening.
Nope.
They do
nope.
have a slant, but I think that they report the facts accurately.
Dan Handelman has a photographic memory of these cases.
He's a Portland treasure. We really don't understand how reliant we are on him.
For many years. I could tell a story about one time. I'm going to tell it. Okay. One time, and I'm going to say it was 20 years ago, there was a city council meeting, the meeting before Thanksgiving, right? It was when we were arguing about the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And so there was a young man who was the assistant chief of police, and I cannot remember his name, a young black man. And he was at that meeting. It was when Vera Katz was mayor. Most of the city commissions were gone. They should probably not have even had the meeting. City council will cancel a meeting if they don't have a quorum, but they had one. And so they were deciding whether or not they should institute the Joint Terrorism Task Force. It was maybe the first time. Maybe it was the second time they voted on that. And the commission wasn't even there. It was a setup. And the young man who was the stand-in, and I feel like Mark Croker was the police chief at the time, who went on to become like a UN police chief on the African continent somewhere, which is kind of terrifying in a lot of ways. But they had this vote and they were discussing it. And the guy that was the stand-in for the chief of police actually stood up and said, "I'm not sure if this is legal." The guy that was the chief of police in absentia stood up and said he didn't know if it was legal. And so the city commissioner started, the three that were left, and I don't even remember who was there, started talking. And they all agreed. They didn't even know what the state statute was that says that you cannot surveil people unless they're guilty or suspected of a crime or whatever, which was part of the issue that was the holdup for the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And Dan Handelman was in the audience. Darn it, he had Oregon Revised Statute in a binder on his lap, and he literally tore that page out, waved it in the air, and handed it up, and they voted it down. And this all happened, like, we're talking about the role of Cop Watch right now, the original Cop Watch organization, the role of Dan Handelman, who is on that police commission.
He is.
And they're talking about the data of all the years that Dan Handelman compiled data, because that's really what he does. He's a data nerd. Right. It still didn't have the same impact as the Black Lives Matter movement. And I mean, I'm really interested in social change and how it happens. I don't believe in reform. I don't mean to be rude. Reform can only go so far, and I'm concerned that our society's actually collapsed already. But when I think about who does good things, can we just talk about that a little bit? For people that are listening right now, they're wanting to know that there's somebody who's going to fix it. They're going to want to know that there's somebody doing something great that they can support and participate in. Can we talk about some of the other organizations and people that our listeners can support?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the things we're going to testify about quite a bit in Monday's hearing is Portland Street Response. This is not just Portland is putting together this mobile team, but there are cities all over the country that are either contemplating or starting to operate these alternatives to police. And the idea is to take a little of the weight off of the police, to do some things that the police don't necessarily do well or don't necessarily need to do, and hand those off to community.
Typically don't want to do.
No, they've got to go out and close cases. They don't need to go and knock on Granny's door to see how she is. But we have Portland Street Response. Well, we were able to get Portland Street Response included in the settlement agreement a couple of cycles ago. So now the Department of Justice is interested in it. And so it's reoccurred in this most recent brief, and we're responding to that.
Talk about that more. What do you mean you got it in? Describe that.
Well, one of the ways we've been able to get programs to persist is to get them included in the settlement agreement. So in order such as the Citizen Review Commission Independent Police Review. My guess is that if Independent Police Review were not in the settlement agreement, it would be gone quite a long time ago. So Portland Street Response is in some trouble right now. It's in trouble because it's got some enemies on the city council. It no longer has a champion at city council. And those meddlers are doing some real damage to it. Some essential tools needed for doing this sort of street outreach have been taken away from these folks. And so we're not seeing the results that we should normally see from outreach teams with this level of staffing and this level of need that we see in other cities. So we'll be talking about that on Monday.
I do have to say that another thing that happened this week, and in a minute we're going to start to run out of interview, and I'll ask you questions about how people can plug into these committees and stuff. But this past week, City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez was interviewed in Axios magazine, and he basically said that he didn't see how the he couldn't say that Portland Street Response was going to be renewed or expanded or anything like that. However, last month in a KGW interview, he said it's the greatest thing since crushed pineapple, and we're just going to throw everything at it. So he's being accused of being, I don't even know what the word is.
Mostly not doing his homework.
He and Ted Wheeler will be guest members of the PSEP on August 16th between 6 and 8:30. And this is open to the public. It's a hybrid meeting. They're meeting at the Portland building and on Zoom. And I hope that there will be some really hard questions posed to both the mayor and to Councilman Gonzalez.
Were you going to say something?
Well, I think Portland Street Response has been painted by some of the commissioners as being enablers of homelessness or where it's actually trying to do the opposite. It's trying to help people who are on the street. And that's a sort of mischief and meddling that's really uncalled for and is oppositional to the success of the operation. They've chased out the program director and some of the top staff members. They've are now questioning the budget, and they've now stopped the expansion to being a 24/7 program. These programs are growing all over the country in all kinds of interesting, riotous ways. And as this conversation about Portland Street Response, when it started, there were parallel conversations starting in Oakland and in Vancouver, Washington, really literally in the same weeks that Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Hardesty first went down to Eugene and saw the CAHOOTS program. Oakland saw the CAHOOTS program that week, and so did Vancouver, that month, and so did Vancouver. Those programs in Vancouver, Washington, bigger, more robust, more active than Portland Street Response. Oakland, twice as big, twice as active. They're really growing fast because they have those city council champions, because they have a police chief who champions those programs, because they have city managers, city attorneys, and the emergency communications team in coordination supporting those programs. And we just don't have that at this point.
Well, I think, you know, Jason can talk about this a little more. There is a national group of people doing this work, and they met recently, and I was just a person who listened in, and it was absolutely amazing to hear what was going on in other jurisdictions in this country.
Dr. Silver, you know, I never stopped and asked and established at the beginning of this interview what your expertise is and what brings you to this issue, but you're a mental health expert. Can you talk about why it's important?
Well, I was the chief psychologist at Damish Hospital for 20 years, and for the next 5 years at chief psychologist at Oregon State Hospital. I've spent my whole life working with people with mental illness, severe and persistent mental illness, and it's just in my heart to be helpful.
Dr. Silver, looking at this issue of the worst possible outcomes, really, for the people that we care about that are struggling, us, okay, let me just rephrase that, us and others that we care about who struggle with some of these issues, what is the most important thing for everyday people who are maybe listening right now to understand about the work you're doing, the police accountability work, all of it? What's the most important thing for everyday people to understand?
Well, for me, the most important thing is to create some kind of mental health system that works. We haven't had one for years, and it's been made worse and worse on a daily basis. And my opinion is that's part of the crisis. People with mental illness are on the street. And perhaps have turned to drugs as a result or other things. And what was decided years ago about closing hospitals and letting the community do the work couldn't happen and didn't happen. And now we're here and somebody needs to fix it.
What do you, and this is a hard question, you do not have to answer it, but in your heart, if you had a magic wand, what would happen? What should be happening right now? I don't know. I'm not sure when I sat in the room with someone with so much knowledge.
So perhaps I'm thinking like an old person that I am. but I believe there needs to be some small hospitals where people who actually need to go, there is a place for them to go. In addition, the community mental health centers need to be increased. There needs to be more consideration for actual assistance as opposed to, this is going to be quite controversial, considering people's civil rights. I am biased, I have to say, in that direction. I don't care if people have civil rights if they're dying on the street.
Duly noted. These are hard decisions. Like we don't even really have a health system in this country. We've sort of got a system for managing medical debt. And I so, okay, final words on this issue. What do you both think listeners should be doing right now with the information that they just gathered to have a positive impact on this situation?
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunities to participate that these committees put forward. Some of them are kind of phony. Some of them drag their tails. Some of them have over-facilitated by city staff or meddled with. But I think that in each of them, you have individuals who have been able to step up and make good comments and push the agenda forward. So I think that's a remarkable environment.
Yeah, I think people just need to pay attention to not get disenchanted, to take another breath. And there needs to be answers. There will be answers. I believe there are a lot of people who are working very hard to make sure that we do better.
Yeah, the chant a couple of years ago was that all cops are bastards. But what do you do after you say that? I mean, what are you going to do about that? Because if you're just going to say, I disengage, they're bad, I'm good, that doesn't get anybody anywhere. And it certainly doesn't help people who are in crisis, whether they're a victim of a crime or a person of mental illness. We need to put together the policies and procedures. The cops will do what we tell them to do for the most part. I mean, they're errant situations, but for the most part, cops do what they're told. It's up to us to tell them. And if we don't tell them, if we absent ourselves from this conversation, you know, we lose.
Right. And just to follow up on that really quickly, there's this organization and it's a statewide bureau called the Department of, it's the DPSST.
It's the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training.
And this is the organization that actually trains every law enforcement person in the entire state of Oregon.
Right.
Whether you're, and we've been talking about the police bureau, but I mean, there's sheriff's departments, there's all kinds of law enforcement that are impacted by this. And a few years ago, before the pandemic, there was a man who was on that committee and they were actually working on different alternative trainings. I always wonder what happened with that. That was probably 5 years ago. And this man used to be the commander of the North Precinct. He was a local Portland.
Carl McDade.
Local Portland cop. And I just, and the DPSST has also, it's also, they finally got rid of their long-term executive director. But I mean, I do think the training is key.
It's a very important component. Now, both DPSST does training and certification of officers and all kinds of other characters around the state. But it's also important to recognize that the City of Portland Police Bureau has their own training academy, their own training director, and their own training policies, which will go above and beyond what DPSST does.
The Portland Police have a new civilian director of training, and I'm particularly anxious to see her work and what happens as a result of that. Sometimes there is an issue with the training itself, and sometimes it isn't the training, but what happens in the field. And there's, the story that the field training director will say, okay, forget everything you learned, and just we do it this way.
Yeah.
Ouch. Okay. I just want to thank you both for being here this morning. That's it for our show. This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. Thanks to our guests, Jason Renaud and Dr. Rochelle Silver from Mental Health Alliance. I also want to say special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making this all possible. KBOO Community Radio is reemerging. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.